time, Molly. Sometimes the music is so good that sometimes I forget to talk.
We just want to let it breathe for a little while.
I was rocking
this,
out.
This is Make Me Smart. It's a thing we do when, you know, when we want to do it on Tuesdays.
Yeah, when we want to talk about stuff. Right. I am actually Molly Wood and normally very professional. I just really like our music. We work at Marketplace, but this is our spin-off podcast where we get to dive deeper into the things that we want to get smarter about.
Are we officially calling this a spin-off podcast? I guess we are, aren't we?
I mean, I am. I don't
okay,
know.
Well,
don't you
look,
think it sounds
charge,
official?
Man, I don't know. It does sound official. It does. If we were TV, this would be a spin-off. I'm Kai Rizdahl, by the way, you know, for the people out there who might not know. I don't know.
It might be in the description, but we're just not sure, so we're making sure.
That's right.
This week on Make Me Smart, we are going to, yes, talk about the news, but all in the context of reputation. That's our theme for the day.
We will make it make sense in a moment. Also, Sally Krawcheck of the women's investment platform Elevest answers our Make Me Smart question.
And we dig in on a little thing that we have been calling the protest economy. All credit to Nancy Fregali, who called it that.
Yes.
And as soon as we said it in a Facebook Live video, people were like, oh, I know what you mean. So we're gonna dig in on that a little bit. But before we do any of that, we actually need your help because we have a big interview coming up and we don't know how to do this by ourselves.
God, don't tell them. God.
We do. It's just that we really want to know what you think. We are interviewing the CEO of Reddit, Steve Huffman, about, you know, whether anonymity matters on the web anymore, whether all viewpoints should be treated equally, how you deal with the problems of abuse and trolling, all issues that are pretty top of mind. And we would like to know if you have questions that we could ask him. So email us at makemesmart@marketplace.org.
Please do, because there's all kinds of stuff to talk with Steve Huffman about. Now, though, the fix. All right, so I'm going to let you start, because this one was your idea. This was your grand thematic approach.
Well, you know, I was watching several things happen over the course of the weekend. And when I say watching, I mean sporadically at best, because yay for a three-day weekend.
Yeah.
Woo! In matters of both federal news, obviously, which is the nonstop waterfall that we can't stop talking about, but also my little universe, the tech world of Silicon Valley, there were several incidents that got me thinking about this idea of reputation and how important or not important it can be. So let's, like, if you don't mind, run down a few stories that I think have something in common.
Okay. So here's the one that got me, right, when you suggest this. James Mattis, Secretary of Defense, literally goes to Iraq to say, oh, no, we're not going to take your oil, in direct contravention of what his boss, the commander-in-chief, has said many, many times, which is we ought to just go and take the oil, right? So that was one.
Don't worry. Also, Vice President Mike Pence went to Brussels to reassure European leaders there that know we stand with the European Union, we stand with the NATO military alliance, and we don't like Russia better than you.
which is also something that his boss has alluded to or said outright, that, you know, NATO is overrated and Putin is a very strong and good leader, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And he said, no, don't worry. We're all cool.
Yep.
Then Monday night, after there was a spate of anti-Semitic action over the weekend. There were bomb threats. There were acts of vandalism, as there have been.
Yeah, I mean, like desecration of Jewish cemeteries. I mean, really terrible, terrible, vile stuff.
Just horrible. And so far, there had not been a response from the Trump administration. In fact, the only response we got was that sort of strange press conference moment where he talked about himself personally.
And told the Jewish reporter to sit down.
Remember that? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just completely bulldozed over that question in a rage. So on Monday night, Ivanka Trump tweeted, America is a nation built on the principle of religious tolerance. We must protect our houses of worship and religious centers. And she hashtagged JCC specifically in response to threats against a Jewish community center in Chicago. And
yes,
today, President Trump himself finally spoke up.
It was after a tour of the African-American Museum of History and Culture on the Mall in Washington. He said, these attacks are vile and we cannot abide them at all. But find me the common thread here, Ms. Wood.
Well, so the common thread, I think, is this idea of reputation. You have these various players trying to protect either their own reputations or the international reputation of the United States. And then there was what happened at Uber.
Well, right. So there we have the larger strategic sort of, it's actually interesting, right? Because it's strategic and America. It's also Ivanka Trump and her brand, which gets us to the brand of Uber. Go ahead.
The brand of Uber. So then over the weekend, there was...
This was bananas.
Yeah. There was a post by Susan J. Fowler at her own blog reflecting, she said, on her year, her 1 year working as a site reliability engineer at Uber.
Oh, is that what SRE stands for? Good for you, because I was wondering that. I was reading her post. I was like, SRE. And I'm like, what?
I went back like four times to find the first reference for that, because I was like, what is the SRE? Yeah. And it's in there.
So she works on the Uber platform, or worked.
She works on the, yeah, exactly. And is one of those rare unicorns in Silicon Valley, an actual engineer, female engineer in tech. And she generally liked her job, but she reports a lot of internal chaos and some absolutely horrific human resources behavior as she tried to report multiple instances of sexual harassment by the same person in one case, in addition to just ongoing problems of sexist culture.
Yeah, and more to the point, when she tried to report these up the chain basically said, no, you're the problem, you're at risk, and we are going to give you a hard time, because they didn't say this part verbatim, but they basically said, listen, keep your head down and do your work. And she finally, after a year, said, thank you, no.
Or you'll be retaliated against, you will get a negative performance review. I mean, things that at least according to California state law, sound outright illegal in terms of retaliation law. And she said, you know, she details pointing out that it's illegal and having them sort of back down, but say there's nothing they can do. And she reports going as far as the chief technology officer of Uber. And this, look, the reason that this keeps coming back to reputation in some ways is because a lot of people, I think, in the Valley read this and were like, well, yeah, sounds like Uber.
Sounds like Uber, which is kind of amazing. Now, let's put a caveat in here about, without denigrating her account at all, that is the account of one unhappy employee, right? But what is telling now about this is this extremely swift reaction from Travis Kalanick, the CEO of Uber, and what he has done, which is fascinating. I mean, he, within, I think, like hours of this thing becoming public, went straight to the whole independent investigation. We're calling the board over and we're gonna figure this out. He also said, in almost so many words, I'm shocked to find out that this is going on in my company.
Well, so that's the part that could go either way, right? Either Travis Kalanick is shocked to discover that this is going on in his company, or Travis Kalanick is shocked that someone who, by all accounts, at least that I'm seeing sort of on Twitter, has a great reputation and was brave enough to blog this in her own name, because these are not... this is not unexpected in terms of what you hear about this company on an ongoing basis. There's at least one female engineer in the Valley who has a standing Medium post that says, Dear Uber Recruiter.
Oh, wow.
Here's my answer. And her post says, there is no way in hell that I would go work there. And so don't call me, because I get calls from you all the time.
Can I ask you a question about corporate culture at Uber? And I suppose elsewhere in the Valley, but this company from the beginning, and I interviewed him on Marketplace in like 2009 when they were just starting up, and he is aggressive and abrasive and wants to blow things up. And now I think that is coming home to roost at the company in sort of the same way that you see, just to complete the circle here, things happening at the White House and inside the government orbit where Donald Trump came in to blow things up. And now people are going, what?
And what happens and what makes this really interesting, and look, you know, I know people who work at Uber, and what they will tell you is that this is a company that is focused on growth above all. And then there's also just the stuff that happens in the Valley. Look, I used to work at a tech company that had an all-hands meeting in a hotel ballroom and handed out 2,000 T-shirts to its employees, all of them in men's sizes, right?
Wow, like
One of the stories that she tells is how the engineers all got these leather jackets, and then they got an email and said, we're not going to order leather jackets for the women because there are too few of them to make it cost effective. So we're just not bothering. That is like the way more blatant version of a company that just doesn't even occur to them to get women's sizes because everybody at the top is a dude. And that is not an uncommon experience in the Valley.
Mm-hmm.
What is uncommon is the unbelievable incompetence described by the human resources arm of this company, unless you take into account that Uber only has, and Travis Kalanick, who is a monomaniacal human, only has one goal. And that goal is grow Uber, period. And put a stop to any behavior, that could impede that growth. There should be zero surprise about it in the Valley. And Travis Kalanick himself is a guy who once referred to his own company as Boober.
Because everybody who read Susan Fowler's blog post yesterday was horrified, including myself. And I'm not uninformed, but the idea that it's that endemic is...
Uber has done nothing over the years, like much like the Trump administration, right? Really a lot of similarities here. The goal is come in and just be a bulldog and try to disrupt the most entrenched industries you can think of, right? Politics and taxi drivers.
Yeah.
And that the only way you can do that is to be an absolute bull in a china shop, and you can never, ever, ever back down. Where this gets to reputation, Uber gives no thought to PR. They don't believe that this flood of negative stories, this constant drip of negativity, they don't believe that that will impact the company. And what happens is you stop getting the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
And I think what we're getting at here is that reputation matters in both government and business. And the real question is, how much can it start to impact whether you get your agenda through?
I don't know. We're seeing it playing out on both levels, and I think it's fascinating. I think it's absolutely fascinating. And we want to know what you think about it, because it's a great insight. Get us on Twitter, at Kai Rizdal is me, at Molly Wood is Molly. The hashtag, of course, is Make Me Smart.
Make Me Smart. Next up, Sally Krawcheck, founder of Elevest, tells us the thing that she thought she knew, and then maybe it turns out she didn't.
So not too long ago, I talked to Sally Krawcheck at Marketplace. She is the founder and the CEO of an investment platform for women specifically. It's called Elevest. But before that, she was in the very belly of the beast, man. She was the chief financial officer, and she ran wealth management at Citigroup. She ran Merrill Lynch after Bank of America bought it. During the financial crisis, she got forced out there after a change at the top of B of A. She has now written a book, which is what I talked to her about. But the idea of getting forced out and not being able to keep doing what you think is the right thing is the subject of the Make Me Smart question. Here you go.
Okay. The thing I thought I knew but found out I was wrong about is that if you play by the rules, you win. And what I mean by that is that I was always taught in business, deliver good results, do it in an ethical fashion, keep your nose clean, and good things will happen. And typically it does. However, when I was running Merrill Lynch for Bank of America, the day I got reorganized out, it felt like fired, but we'll use the words reorganize out, the business was ahead of plan, the business was growing, the business was gaining share, the business's underlying metrics, retention of financial advisors and clients, had improved vastly over the past few years. And so I remember telling my team, well, I'm not real great friends with the CEO, but that's okay because we just need to deliver the results. And the day I was reorganized out, I recognized that it's not just about delivering the results and getting the A on the test. It's also about having a sponsor, having people arguing for you, people fighting for you, having a strong network.
You know what's interesting about that?
Dude.
Hearing it back, right? It goes right to the top of the show, right?
That's amazing.
I know. That was total serendipity. I have to tell you that because I had no idea. Well, all right. I did the interview, but I had forgotten that that's what she said, to be honest with you.
Yeah. I had no idea that it was going to be as relevant because, you know, that was just us looking at a bunch of news stories and saying this is the thing they have in common. But exactly. That's exactly it.
Which is crazy.
And so the ultimate question, and this drives so much of politics, right? Is when do you apologize? How much schmoozing do you have to do? How much diplomacy has to be involved? How much does reputation matter if it's too easy to believe the worst? So, that is amazing.
So you know what's funny? So every now and then, if I might digress here, because, you know, it's a podcast and we can do that. Every now and then I think about running for office.
Really?
Yeah, I do. Because I'm so sick and tired of politicians doing the mamby-pamby, lily-livered, cover-your-ass stuff that they do to stay in office because it's just, it's so patently ridiculous. And then I realized, first of all, I don't want to deal with running for office because it's so disgusting. You have to spend so much time raising money. But also, I would last one term because I would not be able to do the disgusting namby-pambyism, right? I mean, I'm not a guy with that degree of discretion. And it just, anyway. Sorry, digression.
Somewhere there are some politicians and they're just like, come on, man. Like it is true. The idea of trying to maintain a principled stance, but also fundraise.
It's crazy, Megan.
Is a tough one.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we work in public radio, so there's some fundraising there too. But
so we'll get you a tote bag.
It is, I will say, and I think that Mr. Trump is learning this at this exact moment. It is harder than it looks.
Yeah, totally.
That politics game. Next up, we are going to explore the protest economy. What happens when you don't have any benefit of the doubt and somebody and people protest you constantly, but there's an economic side to that that we're going to dig into. Before that, there's an economic side to this podcast. We're going to pay the bills.
All right, so here's the deal with this podcast, as you hopefully know by now. We answer your questions, yes, but sometimes we answer our own questions.
Exactly. And in this case, yeah. Well, and in this case, you know, we thought, I mean, I wasn't here in the 60s, so.
Were you really for real not around in the 60s?
I did not exist.
Wow, okay. All right. All right. Just checking.
It's true. Or for half of the 70s. Just throwing that out there, too.
Man.
So there was a whole period of sustained protests in this country that I didn't know about, wasn't part of. And now we are seeing that again on a large scale. And so we just got to asking ourselves and the audience and each other what is the ongoing economic consequence of large-scale sustained protest? And I came to it partly because a friend of mine, before the Washington March, took me to a yarn store in Oakland. Like, we were meeting for brunch, and she said, I have to go to a yarn store.
Is this the Women's March on Washington?
The Women's March on Washington, right. Exactly. Okay. So right before Inauguration Day and the Women's March on Washington, maybe a week out or something, she needed to go to this yarn store on an errand, and I was like, all right, you knit. No clue, right?
Okay.
No clue. And we walk into this yarn store, and there are there's groups of women and their daughters, and they're all sitting around knitting, and there's this huge pile of these pink hats, and I knew nothing about the hats. We call them protest hats, the pink knit hats with the cat ears. Three women apparently in Los Angeles came up with this idea to fill the Washington Mall with this sea of pink hats. And then they enlisted officially and unofficially knitting stores all over the country to help them do it. So this one, I'm talking to this lady at the knitting store, like, well, how did this happen? How do you have a pile of 400 hats and this, like, mob scene in here? And she said, I had a bunch of pink yarn that I wanted to get rid of. And so she started a donation project, like, buy the yarn, knit the hat, bring it, and we'll give it to the marchers who are going to Washington.
Wow.
So then I went back to the store this past weekend to find out what has been going on since then. Carol Schwamberger of Piedmont Yarn first remembers a little bit what it was like that leading up to the march.
People started coming in, buying pink yarn, wanting the hats, wanting people to knit hats for them. And most of the time we would say, no, you've got to make your own. And so we had hundreds of people learning how to knit, learning how to crochet, people who hadn't done it for years who picked it up again. We had kids coming in, families coming in, guys coming in. And, you know, it's just so exciting.
And then here's what's so interesting to me is that now it's a month later. This is the economic part. She said people are still coming in, still doing classes, and you still can't find the right yarn.
Wow.
The main problem, as you know, has been getting the pink yarn. There's one particular kind of yarn that was sort of the classic yarn used for the hats, and we cannot get that in pink now. I don't know if it's just they are out of the dye or whatever it is, but we have that yarn in dozens of colors, but we cannot get the pink. It's yarn that's made in China, and it's shipped to Cascade in Seattle, and we just can't get it.
I even went on Amazon and looked up different kinds of pink yarn, and there are a whole bunch of different kinds of pink yarn on Amazon, source of all things, no matter what is going on. There are, like, different kinds of pink yarn that are still, there's only two left, or they're back-ordered a month later.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That is amazing. Yeah, you know, this whole idea, obviously, of economic protest and the protest economy actually is not new, right? I mean, it goes to God, examples from history abound. Here's just a couple. You had the divestment thing with South Africa, with university campuses in the 70s and 80s. You had the bus boycott in Alabama, right? You had people boycotting Smith and gun owners boycotting Smith and Wesson after they settled with the Clinton administration in the year 2000. So people boycott all the time. The interesting thing, though, is what's going on right now, right?
I mean, it's been interesting all along, but what's happening now and what kind of sustained impact could it have? When you were talking about divestment, by the way, that reminded me that the city of Seattle recently voted to divest itself from Wells Fargo, I think, investments over the North Dakota pipeline.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, it totally happens all the time.
Yeah. What's interesting now is it's not just boycotts, right? It's this larger question, like what happens when you have people changing their behaviors to such an extent and expressing themselves in the street with businesses for and against, right? Some boycotts are not working very well. There have been really mixed results around whether there are going to be boycotts of Trump-branded products. Like Ivanka Trump's clothing line had problems at Nordstrom. Her perfume, though, has been the top of the Amazon bestseller list. And apparently there was a really ill-fated attempt to boycott Trump wines. In the Northeast, there's that supermarket chain.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just completely backfired. Like, all the Trump wine sold out.
So, you know, first of all, don't ever believe in the rational consumer, right? Because consumers are going to do what consumers want to do. But there's an interesting thing, just to bring it back to Uber, can we for a second here?
Please,
The whole thing at Uber at Kennedy Airport, that night of the executive order, that whole weekend, and the whole Delete Uber campaign.
Which, again, two things. It had a profound economic consequence. People immediately started. So what happened was that there was a taxi strike at JFK.
Right.
The New York Taxi Workers Alliance said from 6 to 7 p.m. on January 28th, there would be no pickups at JFK as a protest to the immigration ban. And then that led to increased demand on Uber, which triggered Uber's surge pricing. Now, Uber no longer makes surge pricing obvious. It just happens behind the scenes. But somehow, like an employee at Uber, in an attempt, weirdly, to curry goodwill, tweeted out that Uber was lifting its surge pricing after the strike was over. He tweeted it out after, and he thought he was trying to say, like, we're not gouging you like we did during Sandy.
Right. Well,
which they were totally criticized for.
Right.
But people still got mad enough, thinking that they had tried to profit off of the taxi driver strike, that they started this Delete Uber hashtag. And that, by some reports, led 200,000 people, at least, to delete their Uber accounts. And again, comes down to, in part, this idea that it was too easy to believe that about Uber because they had enacted surge pricing during Hurricane Sandy.
Right. You know? And because, just to take it back to the top again, oh my God, we're rounding circles here. We're completing circles all over the place. They didn't have the benefit of goodwill, right? Because people know that Uber has a reputation, in many cases earned, for looking out for itself and not for anybody else.
Yeah, exactly. And they suffer like an immediate economic backlash when people suspect that they are doing poorly by consumers. The other thing that I thought was interesting is I found some research on the economic repercussions of social protests in countries where social unrest is much more ongoing.
Yeah.
And there's, including the U.S., but the nut of it basically is that prolonged episodes of social unrest, whether it's, you know, strikes or all the way to civil war, end up compromising the economic activities in those countries.
Okay.
And the political implications can develop over decades as a result.
And it goes to consumer confidence. And are people going to spend money when things are lousy? I mean, nothing happens in a vacuum is the name of that game. The protest economy is not just one side of the political spectrum, though, right? As you see with the Trump wine and Ivanka's perfume. I mean, all of that stuff. So tell us what you've seen protest economy-wise. Would you write to us, makemesmart@marketplace.org or marketplace.org/makemesmart, and let us know what you've seen, because this is, I believe, a story that's going to go on for the next 48 years, honestly.
I think so.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right, one more thing before we get out of here, but I need to remind you about questions for the Reddit CEO, Steve Huffman. We're going to talk to him this week, Molly and I are, and let us know what you want to know from this guy who is at the cusp of a lot of the social media-ish discontent out there.
Yeah, absolutely. And then we have a listener email that we absolutely loved, favorite. Kevin Smith. We got, let me just say, a ton of great feedback about going on a bear hunt.
Going on a bear
mainly
hunt.
Our senior editor, John Buckley's phenomenal reading.
We're going on a bear hunt. We're going to catch a big one.
Kevin Smith writes, I too love the We're Going on a Bear Hunt book, and I read it frequently to my two young boys, 3 and 1 ages. However, as Alaskan residents who may actually see a bear on a hike, the response in the book is dangerous. Run, it's a bear, is exactly the wrong thing to do. You are supposed to stand your ground and make as much noise as you can. There are, just to bring it around again, some interesting parallels to the political protests we've seen in the last 3 weeks on that. But I've been trying to educate my 3-year-old on the proper response to seeing a bear while not spoiling a great book. Parenting never gets easy. Enjoy the leftover breakfast when you need to.
Oh, that one was for you, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. The whole eating the waffle thing. Oh, man.
And that is it. But, oh, man, the emails have been so good. And thank you for all of them. We're basically reading all of them. In fact, it's most of my inbox
not
these
basically,
days.
We totally are, man. That's what we
yeah,
do.
Yeah, we totally are.
Make Me Smart is produced by Jenny Josephson, Bridget Bonner, and the senior producer around here, Nancy Fargali. This week's program was engineered by Ben Tolliday. The theme music is composed by that very same Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez as well.
That's why we rock out so hard. The executive producer of Marketplace is Sitara Nieves, and the senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. Thanks for listening.
Cut it and print it. Isn't that what they say in Hollywood?
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.